Welcome to the Martin Bailey Photography Podcast. It's June 8th, 2011, and this is episode 289. I have a real treat in store for you and me this week, as we have Iberian X Perillo on the other end of a Skype connection, and we're just going to chat and have a, you know, just really chew the fat about various topics on photography. So welcome to the show, Iberian X.
Thank you, Martin. I'm really honored to have to be on your show, because you're one of those podcasts that I listen to regularly, because I think you do a great job with everything that you do.
Well, I'm humbled to hear you say that as well. I mean, partly because, you know, of where you are in the industry, but also, you know, I've been listening to your podcast for years as well. I'm sure that most of the people listening already know and already listen to your podcast, but just to give them a little bit of background. So Iberian X is a photographer, writer, educator, filmmaker. He's been in the photographic industry for over 20 years, and he's been published in various magazines such as Outdoor Photographer, Digital Photo Pro, Shutterbug, Popular Photography and Rangefinder. And he's also just released his own book, which is amazing. I've read it, and we're going to touch on that later. But also, Iberian X is the host of The Candid Frame, and this is where I think that most people will already know of Iberian X from. And if you don't, be ashamed of yourself and just go over there and sign up right now, because you should do. I think, Iberian X, I think when I first started listening to podcasts, I started off with Lens Work and Chris's Tips from the Top Floor, and I think that yours was either the one after that I found. I mean, when did you start? When did you put out your first episode?
It was 4 years ago in February.
Yeah. Okay, that'll make sense.
Yeah, so like you, I started listening to the podcast fairly early on, and I think Chris Marquardt's Tips from the Top Floor was one of the very first ones that I listened to, but soon after that, I got on the bandwagon.
Mm. So, you know, we're literally, like I just said, we haven't really scripted this. We're just going to keep chatting and jumping off on various tangents, so listeners, bear with us as we do this, but hopefully it'll be something that you'll enjoy. But so, When you decided to jump on the bandwagon, did you have any idea that it would become what it is? Or, you know, can you take us through that a little bit?
Yeah, you know, it was one of those things that it was one of those moments in my life where I knew if I did it, it would be successful.
Ah, yeah.
And that all I had to do was just do all the work.
Yeah. Sounds easy.
yeah. But, you know, those moments are fairly rare, but I just felt like I was in the car and I just knew, man, if I do this, I'm sure that it would come off well. Mm. You know, the name popped into my head, and I felt like, God, yeah, this will really come off really well. Because I was listening to all the other podcasts that were happening, that were popping up, and the great majority of them were talking about equipment, and they were fixating on equipment. And I thought, wow, this is such a missed opportunity, because the medium is so exciting in what it's offering, but no one's really talking about photography. Mm. And then I went, well, I know how to interview people. Mm. I know all these photographers. Mm. Why don't I do it?
Yeah.
And so I just learned how to figure out how to record audio using a digital recorder at the time, and learned how to edit on GarageBand, and, you know, figured out how to create a blog and upload, you know, the files into the internet so that people could download them. So I figured all that stuff out, and then I just dived in and just sort of learned by doing.
Yeah.
So those early episodes, I don't even want to listen to, because I sort of cringe. But, you know, it was just the fact that I wanted to create a show that I would want to listen to.
Yeah, yeah.
And for the most part, I wanted to hear photographers talk about why they're photographers and their work. And so that's been, you know, the guiding principle behind the show as it's changed over the last 4 years. But at its heart, it's just about photographers talking about photography.
Sure, sure. Yeah. So I, you know, very similarly, I mean, once I knew that I had to do this, I, you know, I I was pretty similar to you in that I just sort of went through, did all of the stuff, that did the technical stuff to make it happen. I re-recorded my first episode 3 times because the audio quality was so poor. but I was very similar in that once I knew, or once I realized that it was something that would, I didn't think it was going to be as much of a success as it has been, but I had different ideas to you. You know, really with me, it was more about me sharing what I know. I mean, you from the start have brought these interviews with amazing photographers from around the world. And so I can understand, I can imagine, you know, that you were much more confident that it was going to be a success than I initially was. How did, you know, so I know that from your work, you've had a certain amount of connection with the photographers that you will be interviewing through the magazines and things that you've worked for. But, you know, how do you continue to get in touch? You don't need to give us any trade secrets here or anything, but how do you continue to get in touch with the people you do? Because you really contact some amazing, you know, top photographers from around the world.
I think I was kind of lucky that when I first started the show, I already knew some photographers. Like the first photographer I interviewed was John Isaac, who's a legendary
United Nations
photographer. Right. And he was, you know, I knew him. Oh, and wow. So I was, when he was in town speaking at Art Center, I just said, hey, I know you're in town. Would you mind me getting together and me interviewing him? Mm-hmm. And we did this in a restaurant in the hotel he was staying at. Mm. And I think that the initial people that I interviewed were people that I had either gotten to know through the magazines or through my time at Nikon. Mm. And then once I started getting certain names on the roster, it became easier to contact people who I didn't know.
Got you.
And I was able to say, well, I interviewed this person on the show.
Yeah.
And that gave me a certain sort of cachet with people, particularly some of the bigger names, or the more people, or the people who are very, very busy.
Yeah.
So once they started hearing that names like Jay Mazel or Greg Gorman, and people along those lines had been interviewed, they I got a pass.
Yeah.
And so at that point, it was just being able to coordinate with their schedule and mine to either meet in person or to conduct an interview over the phone. Mm-hmm. So I think I was sort of lucky in the fact that I already knew people that had some name recognition. So when I started reaching out to those photographers who I didn't know, and I send them an email, which is largely the means of initial contact, that I list the people who I've already spoken to. Mm. And I think that helps. Not always, because there's some people who are on my list that I've still not gotten on the show, but I think for a great majority of them, it's helped.
Yeah, I can imagine how that would snowball, you know, that just having that sort of prestige behind you saying that you've interviewed all of these people is going to help you to get in.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's amazing. I mean, I've enjoyed every one of your shows, and it really is an honor to be sitting here chatting with you. But, you know, I should also mention, because I'm not sure that every listener to my own podcast knows this, but we've also spoken a number of times on the Focus Ring, which is I remember you opened one, because you generally host the ones that I've been on. I think we've done maybe 4 together or so. But you opened one with, I think it was me, you, Chris Marquardt, and Jeff Curto. Mm-hmm. And you opened it by introducing us as 4 infidels or something. It's like, I mean, that got me cracked up. You know, your humor always gets me laughing. But it's true. You know, it's like it's just like a band of merry men that got together for a chat. And, you know, so the Focus Ring, it's the Photocast Network's, sometimes we get together. We don't do as much as we'd like to. Time constraints on everybody's part, sort of.
And the fact that we're all in different parts of the world,
I mean,
makes that whole thing a challenge. I mean, I miss doing those. Those were a lot of fun. But I think that just the nature of where we are in different parts of the world really make it very difficult to get everybody.
Right. It usually ends up being after midnight for me, so that we can get Chris in Europe on. And so, yeah, but they're fun. If anyone is listening that hasn't picked up on the Focus Ring podcast yet. There's a number of them in there. Just search it out on iTunes or go to photocastnetwork.com and check them out there. But the point that I was going to get to there was that, you know, we've spoken a number of times before. Through your podcast, I feel that I know you, and I'm sure that you hear that from a lot of people. But also, we've spoken over Skype a number of times in the past. And
I've had you on my show, so for those people who haven't had the opportunity to listen to it, you'll find that my conversation with Martin is on the feed somewhere as well.
You know what? I don't remember doing that.
You don't?
Did we really chat?
I think we did.
I don't think we have yet, you know?
You're kidding me.
No.
I thought we had.
You know what? If I'm going senile and have totally forgotten, then I apologize, but I don't think we've actually recorded for your show. Let's check that up. But you know what? If you think that we already have, then we should. let's check that up. Okay. I'm pretty sure we haven't. So, but I'm honored again that that's something we can check up on. It's been great chatting over the years, and I was really, really happy for you and also excited to hear that you'd done the book recently. So, you know, I mean, I've got a copy here, and I'm just going to, you know, tell the listeners it's called Chasing the Light, Improving Your Photography with Available Light. And this is Iberianex's book that was released, 2 months ago now, Iberianex?
Yeah, in April. April came out.
So it's a beautiful book. It's fully illustrated with Iberianex's own work, which obviously that's a winner from the start. But, you know, let's talk a little bit about the book, Iberianex. I mean, how did you... I know that doing something like this is a goal for a lot of photographers, and I know that it was particularly one of your goals. But, you know, talk about the book a little. How did it come about? And you know, what are your thoughts on it having gotten it done now and actually in the bookstore?
You know, it's like you said. I think a lot of photographers or a lot of writers always dream about putting their own book out there. And I know I've been dreaming about publishing something since I was a kid. My parents gave me a typewriter when I think was in elementary school. And, you know, I would just put the newspaper or magazine right next to the typewriter, and I taught myself how to type.
Yeah.
And, you know, I always imagined that one day I'd walk into a bookstore and I'd have a title there, and I'd actually go to the library or a bookstore, and I would go among the shelves and go, okay, my name would be right here. And imagine that one day I would have something there. So it's been a long-standing dream for me to do it, but I never made the time to do it. And then just, you know, a little more than a year and a half ago, and I realized that, you know, if I'm going to try and make this happen, I just need to do the very next thing.
Yeah.
And the very next thing for me was to just write a query letter. And a query letter, for people who don't know, is basically a proposal letter that you send to a publisher explaining what the book is going to be about, what the content's going to be, what the market is, and why you are, you know, the ideal person to put this together. And from all my experience writing for the magazines, I felt pretty confident that I could put together a pretty tight query letter. And so I spent about a month writing out the query letter, writing out the outline, writing out a sample chapter. And I chose Peach Pit Press because I thought they were probably the best publisher out there in terms of photo books. And especially in terms of marketing and using, you know, social media and all that to really promote the books. They're the publisher of Joe McNally's book and David Duchemin. So I felt like, well, if I'm going to keep company, I want to keep company with those guys. So after I got the query letter and put everything together and sent it out, it was a couple of months before I heard back from them. And then we kind of went back and forth, and they signed me on to do the book.
Wow,
and
nice.
And then from there, it was just actually doing the work.
Oh, yeah. I think, again, yeah. Like with the podcast, you know, you figure it all out and then you have to do the work.
Oh, yeah. And that's when you get nervous because all of a sudden it's like, okay, I've signed a contract and they're giving me a check. I've actually got to do this.
Yeah. Yeah.
And but that was a good thing. And I imposed a pretty tight deadline for me. So because I actually wrote the book in about, I guess, 6 months.
Wow.
I probably could have taken longer, but I didn't want to because I was probably just procrastinated. So it was one of those things where I felt like, okay, let me just dive in and make it happen. And you hold the result in your hand.
Wow. Well, congratulations. But also, you know, it really is a beautiful book. I'm not just saying this because, you know, I'm trying to blow smoke anywhere. you go through and you explain. It's like having known you sort of, you know, as I have for a number of years now, and be able to sort of relate to the person that wrote the book is huge, really. And I think that the people that listen to your podcast will also get that, because I receive email from time to time where people they say that they feel as though they know me. They feel like every week they're sitting down to listen to the podcast, they feel like they're sitting down with a coffee or a beer with a friend, and they're just going to have a chat. And I love the fact that people feel that way. But also, you know, I mean, it's going to come across when people that know you through your podcast, as well as someone that just picks this up on the bookshelf, from the shelf in the bookstore, that you can get right into your way of thinking, and you explain in such beautiful detail how you fit, you know, how you work your subjects, how you work the light. And you know what, I actually got a little bit of emotional when I turned onto page 98, and I saw your dad looking back at me, you know. I knew it instantly that it was him, from obviously, because you look a little bit like your dad. I thought, you know, this personal touch of actually adding a photo of your dad in there was really nice as well. You've obviously poured your heart into this book.
Well, thank you. I think that really means a lot, especially coming from you, because I think you do much the same thing on your own show. Mm. But I knew that I wanted the book to be more than just another instructional book on photography. I mean, there's no shortage of that stuff out there.
Right.
And I kind of struggled with finding that voice in the book, but I had a wonderful editor with Elizabeth Kubal, who helped me sort of find that voice. And I struggled with that for the first couple of chapters. But once I found that, it was just, let me just write the book as if I am talking to someone and trying to share my approach to photography with
them. Right, right. That comes across and, so well.
Yeah, and once I was able to do that, it became a lot easier to write, and I was less intimidated about the whole process of putting the words down on paper. And that's really what I wanted to do with the book, because I'm not necessarily the greatest photographer that's ever lived. Neither am I the most, you know, educated or informed in terms of all technical matters regarding photography. But I do know what's worked for me in terms of me making images. And I found that when I taught workshops or when I was teaching photography online, that a lot of people didn't know what I knew. And it was like, really? And for me, it didn't seem like it was a big deal. But I realized that what I was often talking about with people was not so much the technical stuff regarding the camera. It was how I was seeing.
Yeah,
I took some guys out to downtown Los Angeles with me, and I just started shooting, and they were like, "What are you looking at?" And at that moment, I didn't realize that other people weren't seeing it.
Yeah, yeah.
I just assumed that they were picking up all the stuff that I was picking up on, and when I started having to explain it to them, I realized that way of seeing, particularly the way I was looking and responding to light, was something that was missing from a lot of photographers' vocabulary, surprisingly. That they knew how to use cameras, they knew how to use Photoshop, they knew all the sort of technical stuff, but in terms of understanding and taking advantage of how they saw the world, that was missing. And I felt that the best way of being able to bring that out in them was for me to share how I do it and how I see and how that informs all the different things that I end up doing with the camera.
You know what, having just listened to what you said, I've got a kind of a reverse question for you. I had this guy on one of my workshops once that it seemed to be almost like a habit of his speech that he just, every few minutes he seemed to be saying, oh, the light's terrible. You know, and actually, I mean, the light wasn't great. I mean, we were in Hokkaido. It was an overcast winter's day. There was a deer stag standing on top of a mound of snow, and the light wasn't great, but there was a photograph there, you know. And so do you feel as though the light has to be 100% before you'll even point your camera at something, or will you work with lesser light if there's a subject there nevertheless?
The two ways to look at that. I mean, one thing is the way most people look at it is that they look at a particular subject, in this case, the stag, and they want a certain quality of light in order to render it in the way that they're imagining it in their eye. And for me, what I've been doing is I've been more looking as light as my subject. And that ends up informing how and what I photograph.
You know,
there are some occasions where I want to photograph something specifically. And in that case, I'm considering the quality of the light, and I'll recognize that, you know, the light is not going to be ideal for photographing this particular subject at this particular time. But for the most part, when I'm going out to photograph, I'm not making judgment calls in terms of good light and bad light. There are certain better qualities of light, you know, for a given subject. But for the most part, when I go out and shoot, I'm taking a look at the light, whether it's midday or early morning or evening, and thinking about, okay, what are the strengths and the weaknesses of this light? And how can I use it to make any photograph? And then suddenly, if I'm dealing with high contrast light, you know, with those sort of hard light, with those very strong shadows, I'm looking for a particular subject matter that can take advantage of that. And if I'm shooting on an overcast day where the light is flat and soft and the colors aren't particularly saturated, then I'm looking for different subject matter as a result.
I'm with you. That makes a lot of sense. I mean, this guy that I just recalled, he said it so often, it was like, it was almost as though it was just his way of complaining. And I think that there were times where, you know, obviously he was right in many ways. The light isn't going to be fantastic all day. If you're doing a tour like the ones we do in Hokkaido, where you're out from morning till night, the light's not going to be brilliant every day. But I think the difference with the sort of things that we, the sort of work that we do, is that, you know, with wildlife, you've often got to try and capture what's there when it's there. And obviously you grab the shots, you make what you can of it, but then you still hope somewhere that at some point there's going to be the same stag standing in a similar place with evening sunlight, you know, dripping through the trees behind him, or he's spotlit on the there with tree, a beam of light coming through a broken cloud. And, you know, you dream and you hope for those shots, and when that happens, they're the shots that take you to the next level, and they're the shots when published that people notice. So he's certainly right, and you know, it's, I guess I was just trying to figure out how you felt about going for the shot, even when the light's not there, just because you really need to get something from it.
Yeah, well, in that particular situation, like you said, you make the shot with the light that you have. But if I were out there, I wouldn't be continually shooting that same stag,
right,
knowing that the light is less than ideal. At some point, I'll make the best image I can of that stag, and then I'm going, well, until there's better light or until I find a better situation for this particular subject matter, what else is out here to photograph?
Right. Yeah, that's generally what we did. I think we all walked away with a handful of photos, but it was really just to record that he was there and so were we. And so, yeah. No, that's good.
Yeah, but I think that's part that judgment becomes the biggest hurdle to overcome as a photographer, because you go out there with a specific intent of photographing A.
Yeah.
And then B, C, and D may be even more phenomenal opportunities for photography. But because you're so fixated and making such harsh judgments about the quality of light and its impact on your subject matter, you are completely blind to the other opportunities that present themselves. And that's really what I was hoping to get across in the book, is to, you know, understand those qualities of light that can improve the possibility of you making a great photograph of a, of your subject matter, but being more open to what light is doing. Because if you are, then suddenly you will find subject matter that you would never have considered before for photographs. And that's what happened. That's what happened with me.
Got you. Yep. It's, you know what, it's great. It's for these things, you know, like we said, you know, we're really just sort of riffing with each other's ear. We're not, we haven't planned any of this. And so it's great to be hearing you say that stuff. And I find that, you know, the people, when I'm out walking around, if I'm walking with a group, I'm generally, my head's going everywhere. I'm looking left, right, up, down, behind me and everywhere. And you know, generally, I think that people do need to look for not just the subject, but the light at the same time. And obviously, when things happen and it all comes together, there's such a rush. And and it's just, you know, when you're with a group, you generally feed off of each other as well. And you've got, you know, I mean, you've obviously been teaching photography for a long time. You've got a lot of street photography. I remember a comment that I made on the Focus Ring a few years ago that, you know, at the time I was so intimidated by photographing people, for example, that I mentioned that if I had to do street photography, I'd probably do it from a block away with my 600mm. and it's like, I'm over that to a degree, but you have, you know, you take this to the next level. You get really deep in, you interact with your subjects. Is there anything that, you know, maybe let's talk about the anxiety side of that. What advice do you give people that, you know, so, I mean, even for me, what sort of advice do you give for people that are anxious about approaching people on the streets when you want to photograph them?
Don't wait for the anxiety to go away. It's not. It's not.
Do you still get?
Every time I go out and shoot a new day of shooting.
Wow.
And I haven't approached someone that day. I still feel it.
Wow.
That feeling never goes away, no matter how long you do this. But I've learned that if I get past that anxiety and that fear, and I approach someone and make their photograph, that it becomes easier. And, you know, there are different approaches I take. Sometimes I just go up to a person and I start talking to them, oftentimes complimenting them on some aspect about them, their hat, their shoes, the clothes they're wearing. And I usually gush when I approach them, because I'm really sincerely excited about some aspect of them.
Yeah.
And usually from their reaction to that compliment, I'm able to sort of not only assess whether or not they'll be responsive to being photographed, but they also have an understanding of why I want to photograph them. So rather than me coming up to them and going, can I make your picture?
Yeah.
And they're all of a sudden their head is filled with questions as to why you want to make my picture. What do you want to use it for? But because I'm going up to them and I'm acknowledging them and complimenting them and flattering them and letting them know that they are a person that I find interesting and why, usually bridging the topic of making a photograph is not so much of a problem. And I found that that's really, really worked for me. You know, there are other times where I don't do that and I just make the photograph. And on some of those occasions, it's about, I don't want to miss the moment. So I'll make the photograph and I may approach them and dialogue with them further, or I just may give them a smile and a nod and move on. But I find that it's the act of just doing it that gets me past the fear, because there's no
magic bullet.
There's nothing other than doing it. You'll never get over it.
Got you.
So you can live your whole life wanting to do it. And I think a great number of photographers want to do it, but they're filled with terror at the idea of doing it. And I'd say probably 98% of the people who I approach about making their photographs have said yes. And that's over, you know, 20 years and or 30, 40 years of making photographs. Most people, at least in the States, which has been most of my experience, are really agreeable to being acknowledged and being photographed, as long as you're sincere and honest about it, which is one of the reasons I'm often shooting with, you know, a 35 or 85 millimeter and not using a 300 or a 600 millimeter lens to capture pictures of people for the most part. I like the immediacy that I get from using the sort of focal lengths as opposed to sort of this distance and this sense of separation. I want you to feel like you are right there with that with that person, which is why I end up shooting the way I do, and why, as you see in a lot of those book pictures in the book, there's that sense of intimacy that really comes across, or that I'm hoping comes across in
absolutely. The photographs. Absolutely, yeah. Okay, that's maybe why it's getting slightly easier for me, because I have forced myself to, you know, despite the anxiety, to actually shoot people in the street, you know, go up to them and ask permission. But I still don't do it very often. It's really not my genre. It's not the sort of photography that even particularly interest me as a photographer, but although I love looking at work such as yours, and you know, and street photography, or you know, portraiture where that's done in the street, which I guess is street photography, but I enjoy looking at it and I'm inspired by it. It's not necessarily the sort of thing that I really enjoy doing myself, but that's more a time and priority thing. And
and the camera makes me brave, you know.
Yes,
it really does. It gives me an excuse to be able to go up to a complete stranger and start talking to them.
Right,
something that I wouldn't do without a camera.
Right,
you know, put me in a social gathering with a bunch and a mixer with a bunch of people I don't know, and I'm at a complete loss.
Yeah.
But put me outside on the street with a camera, and I'm in my element. I feel a certain level of confidence that I don't feel like at a party or a mixer where I'm just some anonymous, you know, person in the room. But on the street, I feel like I have a certain level of control there.
And
me going up to someone, even if they have hold the potential of rejecting me and telling me that they don't want to be photographed, doesn't hold the sort of dread and fear that it once had, because I do realize that the great majority of people will say yes, and the resulting photograph may make whatever anxiety I felt so worthwhile. And I really like having stories to tell that go along with photographs.
Yeah.
You know, looking at these photographs and being able to tell you something about that person, that there's something very satisfying about making those kind of photographs than making portraits of people at a distance.
Got you. Yeah, great stuff. So a couple of things that you've mentioned there, Birinex, that like you said, like photographing, you initially said 20 and then you corrected yourself to 30, 40 years. And then you were talking a moment ago as well about something that just reminded me of the video, that beautiful video that you put out a couple of years ago about how you got into photography and how you were at the, was it like a youth center or something? And you attributed your entrance into the world of photography to a certain teacher or some guy at the Can you talk a little bit about that, your initial sort of, because that's a touching story, but it's also inspirational as well. So, you know, if you could talk a little bit about that would be great.
Yeah, I was a member of the Boys Club of Hollywood in the 70s. And one of the counselors there was Mike Cohen.
Got it.
And he was in charge of the library and the upstairs of the original building where they were at. So I sort of gravitated to Mike and just really liked him. And he liked me, and I liked the friendship that we had developed. And he was a photo buff himself, and there had been a dark room in that facility on the second floor, just across away from his office, that had fallen into disuse. So he got all the chemistry, cleaned it up, and brought in a couple of photojournalist friends that he knew to come and teach a bunch of kids how to shoot, load the cameras, process the film, and make prints. One day he said, "Hey, come along with me." And I went, "Okay." And I walked in the dark room and saw that print come up out of that developing tray. And I was just hooked. And after a while, all the other kids lost interest, but that's all I cared about. So I would just walk into the club, and I would ask Mike for the keys, and I'd go into the dark room, and I'd load film in, and I'd walk around the club or walk around Hollywood, making pictures, not really caring about what I was taking photographs of. I just wanted to get back into the dark room.
So the pictures were the pictures were like your key to the dark room.
Exactly.
Wow.
So I just wanted the process of making the prints. That's what really excited me.
Wow.
And I was like 8 or 9 years old, and after that I was just, that's all I, it was one of the first things I'd ever discovered that I was good at.
That's huge. And that's huge for a kid.
Yeah, and to get people reacting to the photographs. I mean, one of the photographs in the book is the image of the kid playing pool.
Yeah.
And I think I made that photograph within the first month of learning photography. And I didn't know what I was doing.
Mm.
You know, but I look at that photograph and I remember the response to that and some other photographs. And people go, oh, that's a great picture.
Mm.
And the fact that I could do something, that I could make something and have people respond in that way was unheard of for me.
Wow.
You know, and I was like, wow, I can make something and people will react in that way. I was like, I want more of this.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I think it was that affirmation that I got from photography that made it so intoxicating.
That's incredible. You know, I mean, I have most people, I mean, respond to praise and being told that you can do something. And that, for me as well, that was really one of the reasons that I continued to dive deeper and deeper into photography. You know, the more I did it, the better I got. Obviously, I mean, like you said earlier, I'm under no misconceptions that I'm the best photographer in the world or anything silly like that. But I know how to take a picture, and it might not be the best, but every so often I get one that resonates with people. And when that happens and you get some really nice positive feedback, it's a huge driver. It pushes you forward. But it's, you know, to hear that was a big part of it for you as well, it's kind of not surprising because, you know, kids, that if you get positive feedback as a kid, it can be huge. I got a lot of that as an adult. Even I was a terrible student back in England. I graduated high school. We graduate high school at 16 in the UK. And I graduated high school in 83 into Thatcher's Britain. There were no jobs. There was nothing. And you know, whether you agree with what happened back in those days or not, you know, the politics side is a separate thing, but the way it felt was like, you know, you're leaving school, there's nothing for you, no real need to put any effort into any of this. And I was just more interested in messing around and showing off at the time. And I just didn't have a very good school life. But then when I came to Japan at 24, which was what, 8 years later, I learned like 2 or 3 words in Japanese, and all of a sudden the people around me were praising me for being really good at Japanese. And again, this was like, oh my God, I can do something. And, you know, so I mean, one of the reasons I came here was because I wanted to learn the language. I thought it would be cool to learn Japanese. So I came armed with a bunch of phrase books, and I found a place once I got here to buy better textbooks for foreigners. But, It was really a huge part of it. The fact that the Japanese were so warm and kind, and probably even with my really bad Japanese telling me it was so good, that drove me on to spend like the next 3 or 4 years spending pretty much all of my free time learning grammar and learning the characters and various things. So even as an adult, I respond very well to praise. And so it's cool to hear you say that was a big part of it for you as well.
Yeah, because when I was a kid, I think the biggest arbiter of your value was whether you were good at sports.
Oh, yeah.
Which I wasn't.
Me too.
And so there was a lot of insecurity revolving that. And then I also had a really bad stutter.
Oh,
so
okay.
It made you very self-conscious.
Mm.
And I only found solace in the library.
Mm.
And I didn't find it in the community of other kids, because I just didn't feel like I measured up. But when I made photographs, I got a certain level of acknowledgement from mostly people who are older than me.
Mm.
That really meant a lot to me.
Wow.
And so that was very, very valuable to me. And I think that sort of pervades me still.
Yeah.
Because, you know, regardless of whether it's the photography or the writing or the podcast, all those things pretty much sort of are my way of sort of affirming myself, regardless of whether or not I get that acknowledgement from people.
Mm.
For me, it's reinforcing the things that I feel are good about me, which is has to combat all those thoughts that I have in my head where I'm constantly fixated about where I'm falling short or where I'm less than. So it's the action of doing all these things that keeps the beast at bay.
Wow. You know what? So that video that I recalled earlier, if you could send me a link to that, I'll stick it in the show notes because I really want the audience to see that as well. It's inspirational and it's just a really well done video. You know your filmmaking skills really come across in that. So let's see. I actually have some. What I wanted to do here, I wanted to talk a little bit about what photography means to you. I'll tell you what. Let's do that first. I mean, I know that we've touched on a lot of this already, but you know, today to Iberian X Perillo, what is photography to you?
You know, it's everything. I mean, you know, it's hard to find words for what it means to me. Because from the moment I wake up to the moment I go to sleep, I'm fixated on photography.
Me too.
You know, it drives my wife nuts.
Yeah.
You know, because if there's something on television that's about photography, I'm watching it.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and I'm on the computer, or if I'm going to the bookstore, I'm going to the photo section. And if I'm not shooting, I'm thinking about it.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm looking at other people's work. And for me, you know, I think it's it's part of my genetic makeup at this point.
Mm.
That I could not imagine a life that did not involve photography.
Yeah, yeah.
Some aspect of it.
Right.
Because it just, I love looking at photographs. I love making photographs. I love sitting down and talking to people about photographs.
Yeah.
It's the tool, it's the greatest tool that I have that allows me to take the greatest pleasure out of life. And it's not just the idea that I'm making photographs, but it's really, it's taught me how to see. It's taught me how to see the world, how to see people. It's opened up doors, not just professionally, but it's opened up doors to relationships and opportunities that I never would have had otherwise.
So,
magic for me.
Oh yeah, yeah, beautiful. Yeah, you know. So you said that it, you know, it teaches you how to see, but after the seeing, do you also feel that you get a deeper appreciation for the things around you as well? It's, you know, the things that you're shooting, or even deeper than that. You know, I mean, I feel that photography, in many ways, obviously, I mean, for me too, it's my life. It's everything. I've spent the last maybe 8 to 10 years working towards leaving my day job last year, setting up my own company, and really now. It is everything. I mean, before it was everything outside of my day job. And obviously for you, it's been your career for the last 20 years. So you're already there. For me, it's really just been, it's been all consuming. And like you, you know, I've got a call coming in there. If I'm not actively doing something else, then I will spend all of my time thinking about photography or something related to it, like you say. You know, even just looking stuff, checking people's photos out online, flicking through books, all of that. But I feel as well that it's enriched me as a human being. It's made me a more caring human being in some ways. You know, I care much more about the environment and the world around me because of the photographs that I make. Do you feel that it's had that kind of an effect on you as well?
Yeah. I think it's informed a lot about my life. And when I talk about seeing, I think I should probably qualify it by saying that photography has taught me appreciative seeing. And by that I mean that when I see something, I can see the beauty in it, irregardless of whether I make a photograph of it. You know, I see the light, the way it hits a building and reflects off the building and is, illuminates something that's across the street, and I can go, wow, isn't that gorgeous? And point it out to someone and have them go, wow, isn't that cool? And it's that. That insight that I have to that, regardless of what's happening in the world, what's happening in my life, regardless of whether or not, you know, that check that I was expecting to be in the mailbox today didn't show up, that I can just walk outside or look through my window and I can see something marvelous and take a moment to be just so present that I'm thankful just to be alive in that moment. And that when I'm making photographs, the best times are not so much when I'm making that great killer photograph, is that when I'm out there and I'm so immersed in that moment and being present that I'm not so preoccupied with what's going to happen 15 minutes later or what happened the day before, that I'm just there and I'm feeling each breath that's coming into my body. And that the camera, the use of the camera becomes this sort of meditative practice. And that I'm just there, and that I'm alive, and I'm aware of the fact that at this moment I am very much alive. Particularly when I've gone out and done stuff like you do, which I don't do very very often. But when I'm out in the natural world, and I'm there with a camera, and I'm going, "Wow, isn't this world amazing?" And here I am in this very moment, in the midst of the doing something that I love. And I think that the camera provides me that. It puts everything into perspective.
So you know what, Abirinex, I'm going to drop a bomb here, and I'm going to do this without you. I haven't told you this ahead of time or anything, and I apologize for the way I'm going to do this. But I actually, you know, a couple of times there, you mentioned the fact that you're thankful for being alive in that moment. And you, I actually, I had some bad news yesterday, and this is the first time I'm going to be talking about this, apart from having spoken with my family and everybody last night. But I went to the doctors yesterday and found out that I've got a brain tumor the size of a golf ball in the middle of my head, just behind my nose. And so I was sitting here thinking, you know, exactly the same thing. It's just, I've been so grateful over the years for the fact that I've been able to do what I've done. But there's this slim chance now that I might not be able to continue to do it in the coming years. And so I'm sort of sitting here trying to get my head around the situation. We don't know yet whether it's malignant or not. What happened was, the reason we found it was that a few months ago when I was in Antarctica, just as we got to Patagonia, after the Falkland Islands, we'd come back up from the Antarctic sort of circle, and we'd been to the Falklands for 5 days or so, and we spent 3 days at sea, got to Patagonia, and then after we'd landed and gone to a few ranches and things in Patagonia, that night I had this strange sort of, I call it an attack, I don't know if this is the right word, but I had this strange feeling in my nose, it felt like I'd been punched. It wasn't painful, but it was like the feeling that you get shortly after being punched in the nose. And then straight afterwards, there was like this burst of tingling that went out from my face and my chest, out down my arms and legs. There was a little bit of nausea attached to it, and then a little bit of dizziness. But then literally within a minute, it goes away. And that first time it happened every 30 minutes or so for the next 2 days. Then it spread it out to like 4 hours. And then from about the fourth day, it stopped. And it was very disconcerting. I didn't know what it was. The ship's doctor didn't have any clue really. But then when I got back to Japan, it stopped. And it was like, literally it was 4 days or so then. And it didn't happen for the last few days of the Antarctica voyage, the trip. And so I thought, okay, well, it's probably something to do with being tired, because we'd been at rough seas, and you know, it hadn't really been the best last few days because of the seas and things. So I figured it was just from tiredness and maybe a bit of seasickness as well. But then 2-3 days ago, it happened again twice in one day, and then 2 days ago it happened three times, and I'm thinking, okay, this is pretty disconcerting. I didn't know what the cause was, so we went to the doctors yesterday, had a quick CT scan, and straight away the doctor, it was quite surprising actually. She just, you know, I told her all of the symptoms, and she said, okay, so let's do a CT scan. I mean, I've got a really good friend an amazing photographer friend in Australia called Graham Morgan. And he is also a general practitioner. And he told me as well that, okay, based on what you say, I reckon you need an MRI and all of this. So I went to the doctors, got the CT, and she said straight away, oh, we found it. And I said, what? She said, you've got a brain tumor. And I'm like, okay. I'm like, Jesus, that's how you deliver it. I went to another, she referred me to a bigger, better hospital, and where we went yesterday afternoon, started another set of tests. I'm going for an MRI tomorrow to really see, you know, what it's all about. But their opinion, looking at the CT, and they took another CT as well, is that the same, you know, basically they're pretty sure that it's a tumor. But we don't know whether it's, like I say, it's malignant or not. At the moment, the chances are more that it isn't, because it's growing slowly. It seems to be growing very slowly. It's not doing lots of nasty stuff to the tissue around it. So mm-hmm. It doesn't seem at the moment as though it's malignant. And obviously, that's my hope. But even if it isn't, they're going to have to cut me and get in there and take it out. So it's like I say, sorry for dropping this bomb. I'm doing it partly because I need to let people know, and this is the first podcast that I've done since hearing, but also because you led into it so well there with your talk about the fact, you know, being thankful for being alive, and it's like for the first time in my life, I mean, I've just got my Japanese citizenship set up, I've set up my company, I'm starting to get some traction, and I was sort of thinking, yeah, this is it. Let's go. And then all of a sudden there's this big gap. You know, it might be that in a few years, or even in a few months' time, if something goes wrong in the procedures, I might not be around to continue this life that I've set up and worked so hard for. So it's a big shock. It's one of those things that is like, you know, I mean, I remember years ago I had a gallbladder operation. I wasn't able to go out and photograph just for a few weeks, and that cut me up, and it made me feel very grateful for the fact that I was here, and it made me grateful for the fact that I was healthy. And I still, in all respects, do feel pretty much very healthy, but there's this doubt now. And so it's bringing me back to the old, you know, we're here. We're in this transient state between, you know, we have maybe 60, 70, 80 years or so to do what we do. But all of a sudden, if we were to only have 44 years, what have you done? You know, it's like I sat there last night, and one of the first things I said was that for years now, I've wanted to go to Africa. I had three places other than the places that I've already been, three places that I wanted to go. One was the Antarctic. I managed that this year. And then the other was Iceland, and the other is Africa. And I was saying to my wife last night, if we can get this thing out and I'm okay, the first thing I'm doing is booking a trip to Africa. I don't want to go now because obviously we've got a lot of work to do to get this thing sorted out. And honestly, I mean, I don't want to shock people. I'm going to get through this. I haven't put so much work into everything for this last 8-10 years, all my life really, to get to where I am. To just go and let this get me down. It's not going to happen. But there's a little bit of uncertainty there, and that's what I wanted to really raise here.
So. Yeah. Well, I'm definitely going to keep you in my prayers, and I hope that it turns out well for you. I really do.
Thanks for doing
this. You know, I don't know what to say in terms of, you know, that anything that I said sort of spurred you to share that with me and, you know, the thousands of people that listen to your show, but you know, I think I can speak for everyone who's listening that, you know, that we really care about you, that even though we haven't met in the flesh, that you mean something to me, and everything that you do, has been a great source of inspiration. I mean, just the fact that a short time ago you made the choice to leave your job and make it a go as a photographer. Mm. I personally felt very proud of you for making that choice. Wow. You know, because I know I talk to a lot of people who want to make that same choice but don't. Yeah, and the fact that I knew you, that I've known you, and to see you making that leap sort of encourages me and all these other things where I'm sort of, you know, wanting to do something but have not done it yet.
Yeah.
And hearing what you just shared just sort of instills that even more in me.
Wow. Yeah, you know, I remember communicating by email when I made the jump. I remember you congratulating me and saying something similar then, which was really nice. So it's nice. Yeah, I mean, thanks. It's humbling, and yeah, I'm so happy that you feel that way. And it's really one of those things that, you know, we're tested from time to time. we have to figure out how to get through things. And I'm pretty sure that unless something goes wrong during the procedure, like an actual human error, some kind of mistake, I'm pretty sure that I'm going to be okay. So, like I say, I don't want to scare people. I don't want to upset anybody. But also, I really appreciate the sentiment there, Riverinex, in that, you know, you and I think that other people do care about me, and that's so humbling, and you know, I'm grateful for every soul that thinks of me.
And I think what's a real testament to what you're doing is that you made the choice to change your life before this happened.
Yeah. You know? Well, you know what? And I mean, it would have been nice for this to have happened while I was still in a comfy job and the money was coming in, and you know, and I'd got lots of sick leave that I could have used. But then again, you know, thinking about it the other way, I'm not going to have to rely on people to cover for me while I'm out of the office and stuff. I just won't be able to take jobs for a few weeks, maybe a couple of months or so. But once it's all over, I'm going to be stronger, and I'm, you know, there was some German guy that was quoted in a corny war movie once as saying something like, you know, what doesn't kill us makes us stronger. And I'm a big believer in that, you know. And I remember thinking that on the way across the Drake Passage on the way out to Antarctica, because that's a rough bit of sea. And, you know, you spend 3 days where you can't stand up straight. You can't even sit on the toilet without being launched across the room and hitting your head on the wall. And it's like, you know, I remember thinking that at the time, but then, you know, it's another reminder that, you know, they're all experiences that build who we are. And if I get through it, I'll be stronger for it.
I just got back from Paris. Mm. I was there for almost 2.5 weeks.
Yeah.
And, it's an experience to be in a city that is that old.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you're walking streets that millions of people who are long gone once walked.
Yeah.
And it was very humbling to be out there, because it just gave me a perspective of how fleeting life is, and how transitory our existence here is. And it's just like, and it just gave me appreciation that, you know, here I am and I'm alive and I'm walking the streets of Paris, and how grateful I was for that. That regardless of whether I was making a great photograph or not, I'm here.
Right.
And I get this opportunity to be able to appreciate it. And that, had I not made the choices that I made 4 or 5 years ago, whether or not this would be a possibility.
Because
I was like you, I was working at a job. I was at a magazine.
Yeah.
I had a regular paycheck. I had insurance. I had, you know, a certain reliable lifestyle.
Right.
And then I decided to leave there because I felt like I wanted to do something more with my life.
Yeah.
And being in Paris and realizing that and so many other opportunities would not have happened had I stayed.
Yeah.
And you know, a couple of months ago, there was a woman who was working. I think she was an accountant at some office. And she passed away at her desk, and she wasn't discovered until the next morning.
Oh, no.
And I was like, I felt so sad for her and her family, but I was just like, man, I'm so glad that I don't face that.
Yeah.
You know, that I could pass away sitting at a desk doing work that may provide, you know, a regular paycheck, but that I was aching to be doing something else.
Yeah.
And yeah. I may get frustrated now with the fact that I may not be making as much money this month as I did last month, or that I'm, you know, sitting at a computer instead of going out and shooting, and I could have all those things.
Mm.
But even though I may have moments where I long for the security of that regular paycheck, if I was given the opportunity today, I wouldn't take it.
Yeah.
I wouldn't go back to that, because despite all the challenges and the frustrations that I face, you know, there are certain days where I can go out in the middle of the day with my camera and make pictures and don't have to rush back and punch in the clock.
Right.
And there's something very gratifying about that.
Mm.
And I know that most people can't lay claim to that kind of life.
Yeah.
And I'm grateful that I may not have the success of, you know, some legendary photographer, and I'm tramping around the world, you know, photographing fabulous people and dining on caviar and champagne. But, you know, I have a better life than I had 5 years ago.
Yeah.
As a result of the choices that I
made. I feel exactly the same. I mean, I had probably my best month in terms of revenue that comes in last month. Sold a few big stock photo deals and things, and various other stuff. And I had probably my best month, apart from the tour months, which tend to make me a little bit more, but from just sales of what I do, I had probably my best month yet last month. And I still probably made, I don't know, a quarter to maybe a third of what I did in my old job. But but how much more did I appreciate that money? It was like wow, you know, I'm sowing seeds, I'm working with people, I'm making relationships, I'm making deals, and I'm bringing every dollar of this in to myself, as opposed to working for someone else and they make their money on what you do. You know, there's a direct connection to the things that we do when you're out on your own doing this stuff, you know, like you are and like I am, and it just feels so much better. And I've done everything on my own terms. Everything is, you know, I work when I want to work. I work hard, but I work when I want to work. And it can be solid weekends, but then I'll take a few days off in the week and go and shoot something that I wanted to photograph for. You know, and even that now, I mean, obviously that is my work as well now, so it's still working. But does it feel like work? No, it doesn't. It's like, you know, if I've got a camera in my hand and I'm actually doing something, if I'm doing a commercial shoot, it feels more like work. But it's just, I mean, someone said, you know, if you make what you love your job, you never have to work a day in your life again. And that's true in many ways.
And I think what kind of reaffirms that is when you make a great photograph.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've seen your podcast when you're holding those prints.
Yeah.
And I know there's a certain level of satisfaction when you have gone through all that stuff, you have those moments of self-doubt, and then you're standing there holding that print and you're going, I made this.
Right.
And isn't that great? Like, oh.
Yeah. You know. I was thinking of that sort of thing as well when you were talking about watching the print come up in the developer earlier. You know, the fact that the physical manifestation of the photograph got you so excited, that resonated with me a lot as well, because I love to look at an image on a monitor with the backlit beautiful, you know, screen, you know, that we have now. But I just also love to actually print out, you know, a good quality fine art print, you know, whether the contents aside, you know, obviously, I mean, on fine art papers and all of that, a really good quality print just feels amazing. And I never cease to be, you know, excited by the process of of actually making a print. You know, it's, I'm lucky enough to have a couple of really good quality printers. I've got one, the 24-inch printer now that I do most of my printing on. It's 12 color, does amazing prints. It just feels so great. I'm an engineer at heart. My old job in software was engineering as well, but I just love making things. Since I was a kid, I've loved making things. And when computers came along, they really excited me. And I remember, you know, my first computer back in 95, it would have been, or, well, actually my first computer was a Commodore 64, but we won't get into that just now. You know, I remember really spending a lot of time with computers, and I got into my job as a software engineer, having been to college over here in Japan. And I really sort of, for a long time, was happy. If I was around computers, that was me happy. But then my love of photography that I'd had since before computers came around kind of got a hold of me again when the digital revolution came, and it all became so much easier and in some ways less costly, in others more costly, obviously. But that really got me back into photography, and photography won me back over from computers after that. But then the fact that I've still got this love of computers obviously doesn't just automatically go away. So digital photography is like the amalgamation of photography, the art, and the engineering side, the computer side. And so that is another reason really why digital photography got me, you know, totally, 100%, 120, 200%. So it's like, This has all been for me the last few years such a huge thing to be able to deal with, you know, the art side and the technical side, both of which I love, but then now to also be able to create prints, you know, this physical manifestation of the image, a tactile print that you can hold in your hand, and that is to me the icing on the cake. It's just amazing.
So how long have you been seriously shooting now?
It's probably seriously, as in, you know, really sort of trying to make good images, has been probably 20 years, maybe. I started, okay. I bought my first SLR 20 years ago, shortly after coming to Japan. I'd been shooting since my teens, with various 35mm and even 110, those 11mm film cameras we used to have.
Yeah.
I remember buying one of those when I was 14 on a holiday. But I started to try to really make photographs as opposed to taking them when I was 24, shortly after getting to Japan, which was 20 years ago. Then the digital revolution, obviously, that really changed things at the end of the last millennium, I guess. It would have been probably about 99 or so, maybe 2000. No, I think it was 99. When I got my first digital camera, and then in 2001, I think it was, I bought the D30, the EOS D30, the 3-megapixel first, really, although it was incredibly expensive, it was the first camera really that everybody with a will to buy it could really afford to go and get. So it was really the changing point. And after that, it was more about me trying to just sort of, you know, continue to refine the craft. I really am a big believer. I mean, some people use the word make photographs because they think it sounds cool, and you know, that's fine. But I feel as though I'm making images in the fact that I take total control over the process. This is not a snobby thing for me to say, I hope, but you know, generally, because I want control over the light, I shoot in manual mode most of the time, 99% of the time, and so I feel as though I'm really manipulating every aspect of an image as I shoot it. And you know, regardless of what I do afterwards, I don't do a lot of post-processing unless I'm converting to black and white. But I feel as though I'm making images as opposed to taking them pretty much all of the time. And that really started from maybe the time, you know, shortly after I bought the D30, which was about nine years ago or so.
No, I love your photographs. I think you're great, and I'm glad to hear you've been shooting for 20 years. Because if you told me 6 years, I would have felt really bad.
yeah. Well, there are people that do that, right? Yeah.
Oh, I mean, every so often. Tell me about it.
Yeah. It's both depressing and inspiring. It's like, some people say, "Yeah, well, I've been shooting for 4 years now, and I've just turned pro, and I've done this and that," and it's like, oh wow. You know, it can be, but again, it can be so inspiring at the same time as depressing.
Yeah, but I think it really just speaks to just commitment. Whether it takes 6 years or whether it takes 20 years,
right?
It's really about how much time and effort you put into it. I think a lot of people buy thousands of dollars worth of equipment, and then they only shoot periodically with a camera, and then they wonder why their pictures aren't particularly good. And I think that it's the most valuable thing you have is not the camera, it's the time. It's the time that you make to not only go out and make photographs, but take a look at other photographs. And I think for me, what allowed me to be able to discern what was a good photograph and a bad photograph weren't so much all the pictures that I took, but all the time that I spent on my living room floor looking through all these monographs and looking through all these great photographers and all these great pictures, so that I sort of wired my brain to be able to recognize what a good picture looks like. So that when I was out there making a picture, I was able to, once I was able to discern the importance of light, then I was able to start creating compositions and framing a scene and a subject in a way that I could take advantage of not what was just in front of me and what I was holding in my hand, but all that history and information that I had sort of embedded in my brain and having them all gel together. But that only comes as a result of just a lot of time of looking at pictures and making photographs and just becoming immersed in it. I think a lot of people assume that, well, you have to be innately talented in order to be a good photographer. And I go, that may be part of it, but I think that regardless of what your innate talent is, if you don't invest the time in learning to see and appreciating what a good photograph is and making the photographs, that you're not going to take advantage of whatever talent you may have.
That's so true. I think that, being a good photographer, obviously, you've got to, especially if you're going to do commercial jobs, you've got to be confident that you can go in and get the shots. You've got to be confident that you can come up with the goods regularly and consistently. But it's really photography, depending on what what you're aiming for, it doesn't necessarily mean that you need to be an incredibly artistic person. I think you can come at it from so many different ways. You can learn to be creative, but also you can. I'm still, even though I consider myself a relatively competent photographer, I'm still in awe of some people's creativity and how they can come up with. There's a guy who on my forum, he's got the nickname, the username Mr. Nikon, His name's Dan Newcomb from Canada, and he amazes me always with his ability to just take a theme. We do a competition or an assignment every month, and then our community decides they vote for the top five images. But like Dan, always, and many of the people that get into this, amaze me in the fact that you can give them 1, 2, 3 words as a theme, and then they'll run with it, and they'll come up with such amazing photographs. I can't do it myself. It's like, even though I set the themes, often with the help of some ideas from the community, but it's just, people like that, they amaze me in their creativity. That in itself is one way to be successful at this. There are lots of other ways you can do it. There's a lot of, I've heard said as well, and I'm sure this is true, that the best, even the most creative, and the people shooting the most incredible photographs in the world may not definitely necessarily succeed as as a full-time photographer because they're lacking business skills, for example. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? It's like, you know, being able to shoot an image or make an image or and that actually being able to sell that image are two totally different things. Yeah, and so we like even now we have the market swamped with free images because people are basically either free or micro stock. Whether you know we don't want to get into this. We've already been chatting for over an hour, so you know. But
I think you make an excellent point about people discovering what they are good at. You know, because I look at your images and I love your images. Could I make those same images as good as you make them? Probably not. But I would very likely make very different images than you that you wouldn't be capable of doing.
Right.
And it doesn't make either of us the better photographer.
Right.
Because given different subject matter, given different circumstances, you know, one of us is going to make a photograph that some are going to view as superior.
Right.
But it still doesn't mean that you are the superior photographer.
Right. And on the other side of that coin though, we could do that and there would be another person that sees what you create as superior. You know, and it's like cuz even if you and I both agreed on which we think is the better of the two images, that doesn't necessarily mean that's going to follow through to the audience and anyone else that's selecting an image or just viewing the images, you know, cuz it's all in the eye of the beholder, as they say.
Yeah.
You know, so it really is. It's so, subjective. I always get these two wrong. Hang on. Which is it? We've got subjective and the
objective.
Objective. It's objective. That's what I'm trying to say. So you know, however people look at these things. I mean, I'm often amazed by the images that people select for me to do prints for them. You know, I sell my images as prints from my website. And sometimes the orders come in and I'll say, you know, I mean, I'm happy to a degree with every image that I have on my website. If I'm not, I remove it. So I'm happy that people request any image as a print. But sometimes a print order comes through and I'm thinking, why did they order that one over this one? Or you know, I'm often surprised by the images that people select, but I know from feedback that people generally spend quite a long time going through the images, making their decision on what to buy. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, they're not going to buy something on a whim. They're going to go for the thing that really appeals to them the most. And so that's a learning experience to me as well, because, you know, like we say, I mean, the imagery that we make, one person will see it totally different to another, and one person will prefer one over another, and so it's very much you know into the down to the person that's viewing or selecting an image for a job or whatever.
Yeah. I mean, I downloaded all of the pictures from Paris, and I just kind of was quickly browsing through them, and my initial reaction goes, "Well, all this stuff sucks."
Yeah.
And you know, reality is you know, as usual, the great majority of the pictures don't work, and there are probably some images in there that do work. But you know, that whole sentiment about what's good or better or bad or worse is you know, that of subjective objective thing is happening perpetually, even if you are been doing this for a while. Right. And I think it's kind of important for people sort of recognize that even people like us who have been doing it for 20 plus years sometimes look at our own work and go, eh.
Yeah. I do it all the time. I'm behind by about 18 months or so on this, but I started a few years ago to go through and cull my images on my website. I mean, like I just said, that I'm happy with everything that's up there. That was a semi-truth because I haven't done this for a while. And there are the odd occasion where I go through and think, you know, I'll see an image and I'll say to myself, you need to go through and do the cull again, mate. Because there are a few things in there that I probably wouldn't have put up if I'd have shot it today. So I did that the last 18 months or so ago. I need to do it again. Yeah, I mean, sometimes, you know, you go through and even the work that you were happy with a few years ago doesn't appeal to you anymore, or, you know, you can sometimes think, you know, well, what was I thinking there? And so it's, there's always going to be that aspect, and that's good. I mean, there are. I've got another saying that, you know, your last year's work or your most recent work should be your best or your favorite. And you know, there's always going to be when you're. I always try to give myself at least 2 or 3 days after a shoot before I'll present any images to people on what I've done, unless I've got a work-based time constraint. If it's my own work and I've got the freedom of how long I take to upload anything to my website or show it to people, then I'll usually try and sit on images for at least 2 to 3 days, a week or so if possible, because there's always going to be the emotion of the shoot or the fact that you put so much work into getting this particular image that makes you select something that you probably wouldn't have selected if there wasn't that emotional or, you know, work sort of, you know, the amount of work sort of attachment. So, so, you know, that aside, I do though strongly believe that your most recent work should be your best and your favorite, because if it isn't, it means that you're not progressing. You know, we should all be working, you know, moving forwards in our photography. And there are going to be times where you went to a certain place that gave you the ability to make images that are going to stand out for many years. And I'm not saying that you should just forget about those and they should become crap because they're a few years old. But there really is, I believe, this aspect of your most recent work needing to be your best work, because if it's not, you're stagnating, you're going backwards. And even if you just stop making the same sort of work year in, year out, the rest of the world's going to surpass you. You know, you've got to continue to improve. Yeah. So, well, maybe, you know, obviously that's all down to the person themselves. And, you know, Ansel Adams' work still stands out now years later. So it's definitely not connected to the people around you, you know, with a chain or something, but I think that is an aspect that I always try to make sure that I feel happy with my most recent work, at least.
Yeah, and one of the things, and I think that last chapter, I write that chapter about comparisons,
yes,
about the, you know, the debilitating aspect of comparing your work to others. And,
yeah,
you know, that was a really important chapter for me to include in the book, because I felt that for so long I was constantly comparing what my work was or where I was with my career with everyone else's, and always falling short.
Right.
And
that last chapter resonated with me the most. I think it was great.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
And I felt like it was really important to be able to say that, because I think that that's one of the big bugaboos that we all live with, especially anyone who wants to live a creative life, is that whole idea of comparing where you are at and with your creativity and with your work and with your career, and that at some point it just has to be about, am I doing what I love? Am I doing it to the best of my ability? Am I doing it enough?
Yeah.
And if you answer those questions in the positive, you're doing good.
You're doing
good. And I think that's what I try to keep in mind, because when I compare myself to somebody else, especially someone who's only been shooting 2 or 3 years and they're doing amazing work, I have to take a step back and go, I'm right where I'm supposed to be.
Yeah.
And I just need to keep on and just do all the work that I've laid out for me to do for the day, and do it the best I can, and try to make the time to go out and do what I love and be around the people that I love. And if I can do that, I'm good, because whether I got 30 days left or 30 years left, if I do that from day to day, I think I'll have a pretty damn good life.
Yeah. That last chapter, it was good. It was like, I mean, you mentioned also in there about the equipment, you know, the fact that you sometimes feel that this extra bit of equipment might help you to become a better photographer. And there's certainly that aspect. There's, you know, I mean, I've bought lenses in the past because I need to do a certain look. I wanted to have to do a certain thing with a lens, and that's great. But some people, you know, obviously you'll get the fact that, you know, somebody's shooting this sort of image, they look great, what lens are they using? It's the 50mm 1.2 or whatever. And you think, okay, I've got to own that lens or I cannot be as good a photographer as that person. And that's obviously not always going to be the case. It, you know, gear will enable you to do things that you can't do if you've got a specific goal to over, you know, a wall to climb or a goal to reach. But it's not about trying to get the you know, the next bit of great gear. It's really enabling yourself to do the job that or the work that you want to do is one thing. Trying to keep up with the next photographer and make sure that you have the same gear or better gear than them is dilapidating. It's just not necessary. Yeah.
And I don't really talk about this in the chapter, but I think part of the reason why the purchases happen when they don't necessarily have to is that it often provides the impetus to go out and make the photographs.
Right. That's true. And, that's very true.
And I think that it's trying to find something other than spending the money to create that. You know, because I still you know drool over certain pieces of equipment, and I'm lucky that sometimes I get to use equipment temporarily because I'm going to be evaluating it. And you know, when I open the box and I get the camera or the lens in my hand, you know, I can't wait to go rush out and shoot. So I kind of recognize that in myself. Even though I don't have to dole out the money as often as some other people may have to, but it's not being dependent on those purchases to initiate going out and making the photographs. And I think that's that's a great challenge for anyone. And I think if you can find that, then you become ahead of the game, and that new shiny toy in your hand becomes less necessary, and you become more involved in what you can do with what you have. And then you really can, I think, lay claim to being a real photographer and being a real artist, because you are working within the limitations that you have and are trying to make something great.
Totally agree. So, you know what, Abirinex, I'm looking at the clock. We've just gone over 1 hour and 30 minutes, okay. including the quick chat before we got started. So let's call it a day. Thanks so much for your time. It's been a pleasure, you know, I always enjoy communicating with you, but having, you know, speaking directly like this, it's always great. So really, thanks very much for coming on my podcast, and hopefully... you know, we'll get a chance to talk again soon.
Yeah, I'll definitely have to have you on my show sooner than later.
And I didn't intend to say that, but then when I said I emphasized my podcast earlier, I thought, oh crap! I didn't mean to say it that way. Sorry.
No worries. Yeah, but I feel very honored to have the opportunity to be on your show, and I wish you only the best with everything that you're doing, especially in regards to your health and. Give my best to your lovely wife.
Will do. Will do. All right. Well, really, thanks so much, Abirinex. It's been a pleasure and a lot of fun.
All right, brother. You take care of yourself.
Will do. Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye. All right.
Bye-bye.
This is Dave Warner, and I'm the host of the LensFlare35.com podcast. Each week I bring you interviews with some of the top photographers using digital SLR cameras. They share some of their coolest tips and tricks, techniques and news about what they're up to. So please take a moment to visit the website or subscribe to LensFlare 35 on iTunes.
The Martin Bailey Photography Podcast is a proud member of the Photocast Network. Find this and other great photography podcasts at photocastnetwork.com.